And so then the first question we want to ask to all of the panelists and the speakers from the morning is maybe if you could embed your talk into the larger body of research, and then what do you think are the most pressing opening questions in the line of research that you discussed? And then after that, we'll take any remaining questions and then open the floor, or remaining questions from this morning, and then open the floor for more. So, maybe Abhay, do you want to kick it off?
Okay. So I think that there's a difference between what I think are the most pressing questions and what are the most pressing questions in the context of this workshop and my talk. So I imagine I should focus on the latter. So in the broader context, my talk was meant to be really providing guideline for for the kind of conceptual plus mathematical framework that is absolutely, that would be necessary in whatever the future theory of quantum gravity is, the final theory of quantum gravity is. And the question is that it should have those minimal structures. So can we extract those minimal structures? And I just took a concrete example about this T violation. And I just want to emphasize very, very strongly, because this is confusing to some people, but T violation that I'm talking about at the fundamental level has absolutely nothing to do with the error of time. I mean, I did say it quickly, but just want to emphasize it again. It has to do with the fundamental laws, as we know them, as we call them today, if they have a certain symmetry. Okay, so then that is the larger picture, the larger question, namely that what will be the minimal mathematical structure that should be there. Now, of course, there may be an additional mathematical structure as we have in quantum mechanics, but perhaps as Lee pointed out in his thing, I mean, that there are no Hilbert spaces there, there are no clear operators there. And also in the little example I gave, which was just a small extension of, re-looking at quantum mechanics, there were no Hilbert spaces, no operators, there were just manifold geodesic distance, killing vector fields and such thing. And so there might be some nonlinear framework in which we'll have to consider for quantum gravity. And in particular, the linear framework of quantum mechanics may be something very limited, just like, considering Minkowski space locally around us is something that is limited. So that was the goal. That was the goal of the talk, to try to just provoke people to think in terms of this.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Not sure if Bianca's on the call right now, but maybe Klaus, do you want to summarize embed your work in sort of the bigger literature? Although I think you did give a nice summary of things. And what are the most pressing questions in the line that you're thinking of?
I'm not sure whether I acoustically understood everything. So you want me to summarize my talk?
Or just sort of the big picture, and then what are the open questions for you?
Well, I mean, I try to start, say, from a concrete approach to quantum gravity, such as quantum geometrodynamics or the loop theory or string, and then discuss issues within that approach to come up with a complete and consistent picture. I mean, that's what I try to give. That eventually has to be tested, of course. I mean, we are not that far yet, but I think before we have not tested it, we should have a complete and consistent picture. This is what I tried to develop based on quantum geometrodynamics. I'm sure that also from the loop theory, which is also based on quantizing GR, still similar picture arises for string theory, especially with ADS CFT. I think one should be a bit more careful, but I leave that out. No, so that's the idea. So to take an approach and try to develop this as much as possible to have a complete and a picture. This is for the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. You get, this structure of the wave equation that at least in cosmology is, I would say, consistent mathematically. And then the important thing is this semi-classical approach, which in a sense is built in. This is what I emphasize with this analogy with Schrödinger, that at least formally, this limit of geometric optics from wave optics is similar than having this Born-Oppenheimer limit from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And you can test it in principle by having then these quantum gravitational corrections and going to the CMB power spectrum. I mean, there are other possible applications, but for this you need primordial black holes. So then you have, say, the Hamiltonian, the Wheeler-DeWitt Hamiltonian for a black hole. There are certainly simple models available, but not yet any realistic picture. And I don't think I should say that, say, quantum geometric dynamics is the fundamental theory of quantum gravity. I think it's the first step, or I think that's when you open the door to quantum gravity first. What you find, in the same way as you find Schrödinger equation, as in the way Schrödinger did, no? And Schrödinger equation is not the most fundamental exact equation. It does not describe, say, quantum field theory, for example. And also you have, say, if you apply it to the hydrogen atom, you have certain boundary conditions at the origin that you impose independent of whether there are quarks or not. So that's also, say, the first step to the quantum theory. And we know it's consistent and it gives us the explanation for plethora of experiments. So that's how I see that picture, not as a final one, but as a way, also a conceptual way to ask questions, but always with an eye towards possible observations. Now, of course, there are many issues. I don't want maybe to take too much time now in this, but I think there was the question in the chat about the Hilbert space structure and the full theory. And that's one of my of course, questions I had at the end of the talk, and up I answered already in the chat about this, that it's mostly heuristic. That's true. And my question was whether this probability interpretation is needed beyond the semi-classical level. What we certainly have to impose and what we did in the past was that, say, when constructing wave packets, that should not have support in classically forbidden regions. That is, you have, even if you don't have a formal Hilbert space, you impose, say, the wave function going, say, to zero in the region where the universe is not. And I think that's at least a minimal agreement. I guess there is a mathematical structure at the most fundamental, which we still have to disclose.
Great, thank you. So Lee, do you wanna go next? Maybe if you can, embed your stuff and then sort of the bigger picture
then Bianca.
Okay, I wanted to give Bianca a chance to acclimatize. I know she just signed on, but if you want to, it's up to you.
Either
guys
way. Well, Bianca, up to you.
What is the question for me?
So the question we're asking is if you could embed your talk maybe into the larger body of research and the theme of the conference, and then sort of outline what you feel are the most pressing questions in your line of research.
Okay, so Lee, you don't want to go first.
I'm happy to go. I know what I want.
Yeah, it's fine. So, I'm coming from quantum gravity, so I'm really trying to directly construct theories of quantum gravity. And in this particular approach, form notions of quantum geometry. So I do think that distinguishes, for instance, new quantum gravity or spin forms, that we do have this kind of notion of quantum geometry first, which comes from kind of many directions. And impose the dynamics on that. As I mentioned, is also one of the few approaches which you know are able to work directly with Lorentzian geometries and aim at implementing the Lorentzian path integral. I did put a lot of emphasis on the path integral in the talk. I don't think there is a big distinction between path integral and canonical approaches. So we do understand where they are connecting and where they're kind of different, giving different results, and where, you know, they are related to Wheeler-DeWitt. So one issue where, one point where they are kind of give different things, or where you would have to change the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, is actually in this question of including topology change in space, for instance. But otherwise, if you don't do that, we know and expect that they're pretty much equivalent, and that you can also treat questions like what is the physical inner product and so on, at least on a heuristic level. So the bigger, via this notion of quantum geometry and also quantum dynamics, we do hope to get insight into what is quantum space-time. As I mentioned also in my talk, I do think an important aspect there is not only to come up with models, of which there are many, but also able to kind of get answers and compute from these models. So I mean, quantum gravity goes on, I don't know, roughly maybe 60 years or so on. And so there's kind of actually models which are around for a long time, but it's really hard to extract answers from them for these reasons, that it's just kind of very hard, for instance, to actually compute the sum over all triangulations or all causal sets. That's where spin forms again, or loop quantum gravity, can have an advantage, because there's a rich structure, which on the one hand makes certain things difficult, but actually it does connect to interesting techniques like topological quantum field theories, and so questions which other approaches have had a hard time to answer, like is there a smooth manifold structure, are kind of could be simpler in this approach. So that's, and there are kind of more techniques available to evaluate sparse integral, particularly with respect to the semi-classical limit. So most pressing questions for me in my research is indeed to improve on this connection between microscopic models or the quantum mechanical models and the macroscopic outcomes. And so that you can see as kind of an open question is really to know whether, for instance, loop quantum gravity has a right or has a suitable continuum limit. And if we could improve on this, basically, make basically this little pass into a highway, that would just allow us to much better or faster also conclude from what kind of microscopic ingredients do lead to which macroscopic picture. So for instance, if you do allow causality violations or not, what does it mean macroscopically? And I just said kind of there are many models which kind of which propose things, but it's again, it's typically quite difficult in that some models are 30 years old, but you can't compute really what happens for the four-dimensional full model or even for the two-dimensional model and so on. So if we would be able to do that, we would have just much more information already, which microscopic models, which are all informed by some foundational ideas, which are valid and which are not valid. And so it's, in my view, in the history of quantum gravity, there were always a lot of surprises of what kind of microscopic inputs led to which macroscopic outputs.
Thank you. So same question to you, Lee.
Yes, to me, what's most important is experiment, even if I don't do it and I don't think about it very productively. In all cases, experiment. What Abhay talked about was closely connected to experiment and to the possibilities of quantum gravity actually explaining something that seemed. And that's always what I'm thinking about. And since this is a meeting, if I understand it right, sponsored or very friendly to people in quantum information, let me take the opportunity of answering a question that I thought I would get when I showed the extension of the Schrodinger equation beyond the Schrodinger equation to the nonlinear terms. There was a parameter there, n. Nobody raised their hand and said, what's n? Although it's clear that the corrections are proportional to 1 over n. So to be provocative, I'll tell you what n is. N is the number of, when I invent that probability measure, I implicitly normalize rho to be to such an integral rho is equal to 1. But that n is really the integral rho over the manifold. And it's the number of similar quantum systems in the backward causal light cone of the system that we're studying. And so I challenge people in thinking about experiments in quantum information. Can you make some systems which are rare, which are not naturally expected to have precedence in the past backward light cone, so that those ends will be small? And if those ends are small, then that predicts deviations from quantum mechanics, which are the smaller n is, the larger the corrections are. And so I challenge people in quantum information laboratories to make us systems that are sufficiently complex combinatorially that we can expect n to be small. And the last, if you absolutely force me to, there's an obvious science fiction payoff. Nobody forcing me? Okay. The obvious science fiction payoff is that if n is not very large naturally, but you don't see the effect, which means that n is actually large, you're measuring the number of other groups in the galaxy which have quantum information machines or laboratories. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Lee. So that was great. Did we have any questions that were carried over from the morning? I know I saw some in the chat and there might've been some because I want to make sure we get to those. If people are in the audience, if they could raise their hand, if there's stuff from this morning. And if not, maybe—
Can I just make a comment on the thing that was just said by all of us? Just very quickly, as people are raising their hands. I think that there is a distinction between the Wheeler geometry dynamics that Klaus talked about and look on gravity. I mean, at a broad level, they are very similar. But for example, I mean, there are qualitative differences because if you just take that picture seriously and complete in a natural way, the geometry dynamics by putting appropriate inner product in the Hilbert spaces and so on, which one can, then one does find that in fact, there is no natural resolution of the Big Bang singularity, using any of the approaches, including more general interpretation of quantum mechanics. And in Lucan gravity, there is actually, Lucan cosmology, there is actually a resolution. So I think there are differences, which they're not minor differences, they're interesting differences. And this idea about going from micro to macro that Bianca just mentioned, I think that is really very fundamentally very interesting. And again, some work in loop quantum cosmology has really done that. Namely, one has really talked about the presence of the area gap actually give rise to curvature scale, the big bounds. And then that curvature scale affects what happens to the cosmic microwave, to the cosmological perturbations. And actually some of the anomalies that we see in CMB, which are macroscopic, are actually alleviated precisely because of that scale. That scale comes in very much. So, and one can also do the conversely. One can just say that, well, supposing given the observations, so macroscopic thing, can we actually constrain, and assuming look on cosmology, can we actually constrain the area gap, which is a microscopic fundamental parameter that is coming up? Can we constrain that from observations? And again, the answer is that we can constrain it, and it is actually in agreement within the experimental, 66% confidence level with the calculation that one does from black hole entropy. And so there are such things that the concrete things that are being done, and I hope that more and more such things will be done in all approaches, not just look.
All right, so I see we have some hands up. So on my screen, Patrick is up first on the left. So maybe Patrick, do you wanna?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I wanted to thank all the speakers for very, very interesting talks. I learned a lot from this. My question is for Lee, and this is kind of, I have kind of two questions. One, which I think is should be fairly straightforward and just clarificatory. And then the other one's a little bit more substantive. So the clarification question is kind of related to Ian's question from before about how to make sense of momentum and energy in this framework. It seems to me like the way that you set things up, you take by taking temporal order and causal relations to be primitive, you could almost look at like momentum and energy as being like those quantitative features that further specify what sorts of causal relations are indicated by causal interactions. So like if you have this causal graph, you've got two points that are related by some cause, it sounds like a natural interpretation for momentum as you've framed it would be like the momentum corresponds to the features of that causal relation viewed as more than just an arrow between two points and actually something that has qualitative content as well. Does that kind of make sense?
That makes sense, sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes
okay.
Sense. Okay. Right. In the context of, for example, debates between philosophers about the meaning of causation so forth. Somebody whose name I can never remember, but who's a very good philosopher, who said to me, you can't just have causal relations. Causal relations have to relate something. Strauss and Galen Strauss. So you can think of it in that context, yes.
Right. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So my more substantive question is kind of after listening to Abhay's talk as well, is there a sense in which time reversal could make sense within this kind of causal theory of views that you've developed? Is it like, if you've got this kind of view of time that's kind of becoming, does it make sense to talk about like temporal reversal?
Yes, that's very important. And it's a question that we address in two of our papers. And then there was also a paper with Andrew Little that addressed this in more detail. So the question is, normally we assume that the fundamental laws are time reversible, and we look for special boundary conditions to pick very unsymmetric initial states or very low entropy initial states to explain the irreversibility that we see. We're positing the opposite. We're positing that the most fundamental relations laws are irreversible. But of course, we have to explain why the dynamics and intermediate scales that we all see, like Maxwell equations, general relativity, et cetera, are time reversible. So that's something we explicitly have to do. We have to show, can you invent fundamentally or theories that are irreversible fundamentally that can go into phases where they discover reversible phenomenon? And the answer is absolutely. That's actually a pretty common circumstance in discrete dynamical systems. It has to do with the formation of limit cycles. And one of our papers with Marina asked that question. We didn't know the answer. And then later we understood that what was going on in our models was the formation of limit cycles. And the idea of a limit cycle, how it connects to the discussion, is that, I mean, we say that general relativity, to let me say just Maxwell theory, is time reversible, but we only see in our universe retarded solutions. We only see solutions which send information to the future. And we don't see any solutions which send information to the past, and that's because we actually only study a fraction of the solutions of Maxwell equations, those that are in agreement with certain boundary conditions that we put on at future infinity or something like that. So the theory that we're dealing with is a time asymmetric theory, but it's a truncation of a time symmetric theory by some boundary conditions. And you can ask if the reverse happens, that is, if there's a theory which is time asymmetric, which goes to a phase, which looks exactly like that time asymmetric phase, but of a time symmetric theory. And we wrote a number of papers about that.
Right. Very interesting. I'll have to check out those papers. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Great. So I see Namrata's hand and Siddhant. So maybe, I hope I'm saying that correctly, but maybe Namrata, do you want to?
Sure. Thank you, everyone, for your talk. I have a question for Lee. Okay. So I just wanted to double check, first of all, the events that you mentioned. Are they like the amalgamation of all the previous events? Like is there a compounding event, compounding effect of subsequent events in the one event that you look at, like a view of it?
Yes, we thought about that. In other words, does the what we're calling the view of an event combine the views of all the prior events and bring them forward? And we thought about that, but in the models that we've been studying, the answer is no, we don't compound that one.
Okay, so I mean, if you were to do, if when you did the compounding effect, then I think you would see a different, you would see the time dynamics be different.
You'd have to ask Marina because this is mostly numerical work that she did. And
okay.
I mean, she chose to, there is a measure of the, well, no, let me, that's not gonna, it's complications of numerical work, but you can ask us and we'll explain to you.
Okay.
Right.
So and oh. I'm sorry. I just have like one more thing to mention. So with your this theory where you know you look at the events and everything else would be like an emergence, how do you define how do you define complexity or like let's say increase in entropy as you have these causal relations like
We use the measure I discussed called variety, or things closely related to it. But that's not, it's not, I don't have an argument that's the only measure of complexity you need. That, what's beautiful about that one is the result that under a certain limit, it reduces exactly to Bohm's quantum potential. But if we now understand, and I can explain why Bohm's quantum potential is the first order term in any such expansion of a measure of complexity. So it's not that surprising, it's probably rather general.
But yeah. That's where you brought in network theory?
No,
I look at the variety?
Network theory because it's, I don't know something by network theory, but what we're substantially talking about is a graph of past causal relations. And the assumption or the idea of making a framework where the viables are the views of the events, asymmetric, because they're the past views, they're the information coming from the past. That to me is a very interesting idea, and certainly time asymmetric. But it is actually true that those variables all communicate with each other. That is even say in classical general relativity, if you smear the electromagnetic fields onto spheres and decompose into incoming information and outgoing information, that particular subset of incoming information does commute along with itself.
Right. So I see three more hands up, and so I want to make sure we can get to everyone's question. So if we can just keep that in mind when asking them. So Siddhant, I think you were up next, and then I saw Lorenzo, and then Harvey. Siddhant, please.
So my question is for Abhay. So I think you had a really compelling argument from the study of the decay processes that, you know, one might have to reconsider the notion of time reversal invariance. So my question is, if we imagine such a future theory where fundamentally equations are in some suitable sense not time reversal invariant, there is some work to do for the theory to explain the appearance of time reversal invariance, basically in all of non-relativistic and relativistic quantum mechanics governed by wave equations, and essentially all of classical physics, both particles and fields. So do you have some suggestions or thoughts about how such a deductive program would proceed from a fundamentally time reversal non-invariant theory?
Yeah, so there are two different things. One is the kind of thing that Lee was talking about, in which perhaps time reversal invariance is broken in a very, very brutal way. And then, of course, there's a lot of work to be done, really. I mean, to show that, I mean, like what Lee was saying, that maybe in some patches of the theory space, there is still a time reversal or a very good approximate time reversal invariance. Okay, but the main point is that if I just look at standard physics, right? In standard physics, we got the weak interactions violate T invariance, and those violations are small. I mean, so it can just be that the time reversal invariance and the lack of time reversal invariance at the fundamental level is really a very controlled. Not everything is time reversal invariant. Not everything breaks time reversal invariance, but only certain things do. Like, for example, a thing that will be like the weak interactions. And there's no contradiction whatsoever, right, today, between the fact that electromagnetic interactions are time reversal invariant and strong interactions are time reversal invariant, but the weak are not. So, I mean, it's not very profound way, a profound input that would be needed to get the appropriate time reversal invariance in Maxwell theory or something. I mean, it all depends on Lagrangians that you write down, or interaction terms of
so maybe dynamics. Right, my question is more like, if I were to view some of, let's say, the Maxwell theories emerging from these very microscopic fundamental theories, at which stage do you think the time reversal invariance appears? Or like, what's the new physics that's coming up? Do you think we have collections of these fundamental particles and the equations for them suddenly have time reversal invariance appearing, or like?
Lack of that, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the statement would be that, even at a fundamental level, right? I mean, whatever your fundamental theory is, which we don't have today, but whatever the fundamental theory is, that theory would have, I don't know, whatever the Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian or the amplitudes, in spin forms, some amplitudes and so on and so forth. And the statement is that there will be some processes in which there will be time reversal invariance broken. But again, you know, you have got quantitative Lagrangian, so you have a coupling constant in front of that. And that is the reason why, for example, time in the time reversal invariance in the K-on system decay, the primary decay channel doesn't break time reversal invariance. It is the other decay right. channel that does. So that's the kind of thing that will just come out. I don't consider this as a major issue, right? I mean, but what is a major issue is that whatever your fundamental framework is, it should have the ingredients which allows you to pose this question and answer this question.
Mm-hmm. But I so just to wind up, these branching ratios, which suggest that something is small or large, is ultimately related to free parameters in the theory.
Right? Oh yeah. So right. Then, so I'm not saying at all that
have an explanation. Of right.
So
years.
I mean, this was where I might have differences with these point of view. But I kind of feel that I would be happy if I just understood how and not why. I mean, I feel that the main challenge of physics is really how rather than why. How does something happen? You know, we see something happening and then so what are the fundamental laws that govern that happens. And then hopefully these fundamental laws are very few. Now there is a there's another question, which is why are these fundamental laws and not something else? That is not to be a question of physics.
Thank you for your response.
Thank you. So I see, I know Lorenzo had his hand up, but I don't see him anymore. So maybe Harvey, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah, thanks very much. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Thanks. I have a question related to probability, and I'd like to address both Klaus and Lee about this. Klaus, you raised, I think, what is a very well-taken point about the issue of probability in quantum cosmology. Where does it come? Is it fundamental? I mean, does it reside in the fundamental features of quantum cosmology? And the question that I wanted to ask you was, am I right in thinking that by looking at the Mott analogy, you likewise don't get any handle on something like the Born rule by looking at how you derive the time-dependent Schrodinger equation from the time-independent equation? So that's my question for Klaus. For Lee, I'd like to ask, Lee, I had to leave the room precisely when you introduced probability, so I just wanted to see if I've understood. There's nothing stochastic in your dynamics. So your notion of a probability distribution is really based on combinatorial considerations. And I would say that there's a difference between counting and expecting. So I'm not quite sure why you call this a probability distribution. Of course, you normalize it, but to me, it's exactly the same issue that arises in classical statistical mechanics. Why do people call the Liouville measure on the phase space a probability distribution?
Harvey, thank you. That's one of those key deep questions about probability that I think I don't have a great insight to. But I'll just deflect with one thing. Sometimes when we actually, in fact, all the time when we actually construct a model of events in this causal structure, and we have a rule that continually that creates the events, that is a stochastic rule. The rules we choose to work with are stochastic rules. But we don't think of that as fundamental, just aids to computation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, thanks.
Yeah, if I may then answer. So in Mott's paper, the Born rule is taken for granted. Yeah, so there's no derivation of it. And there's the question, of course, whether you can derive the Born rule in, say, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And this has been attempted by many people. In old papers by Hartl, David Deutsch also prized a bit. Wojciech Szurek in 2005, and they have all been criticized by putting at this part of the result in the derivation. So I must confess, I like very much Turek's paper, because yeah, he puts something in, that's true, but that may be rather natural. I mean, we cannot maybe discuss the technical issue. So it depends on how you, what type of rigor you impose. I would say that at least Turek's and others' derivations show the consistency of the whole formalism with the Born rule. Yeah, so when Pauli, very early on, following answering Ehrenfest's a question about this, he made a point also about simplicity. That, I mean, this Born rule is maybe the simplest that that can be imposed if you want to have probability and its conservation. No? So definitely the Born rule is just imposed in Mott's paper, and the derivations in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, they are maybe not complete. In quantum cosmology, I would say you have the picture that you get the semi-classical limit in this von Oppenheimer approximation. Then of course you can go to quantum mechanics, you can impose the Born rule, or you can impose Turek's type of derivation and so on. But the point is what happens beyond that. I think for having probabilities and for the interpretation, you need a semi-classical realm, or what Hartle and Gell-Mann called IGUSs, information gathering and utilizing systems. So you need a decohered part of the wave function.
Yes.
And but then you are in the semi-classical limit, and you can, the remaining ones, even if it's beyond, say, the Schrödinger approximation, the remaining wave function, I think you can impose the probability interpretation, but I have a hard time to see, to merge this when there's no IGUS, I mean, no semi-classical realm. I think there's just no probability or no question of probability, but that's my opinion.
Thank you very much. Is there time just for a follow-up?
I feel bad saying no, so so go for it.
Say no if you need
no, to. No, I mean, I just want to make sure we have time for Lorenzo's talk and, or question, sorry. And, but yeah, I think we have a bit of time, so. Yeah.
Well, I mean, just very, very briefly, the issue for me is not so much whether the probability rule is the Born rule or some other rule. It's why there are probabilities at all. And for example, you mentioned Deutsch. Deutsch, of course, has a decision theoretic approach. And the issue again is it's not so much that he gets the Born rule, it's the fact that for Deutsch and many others, probabilities ultimately have to do with expectations of rational agents. No agents, no probabilities. So they
well, can't. No IGUS. I know no agent, no probability. That's what I
maybe well, an IGUS was. Is a necessary condition for a rational agent, but it's not a rational agent. And rational agent requires consciousness and expectations and all the rest of it. So,
okay, that's true.
In that sense, is a human construct.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I agree with that.
It's something we can all aspire to.
Sorry?
It's something we can all aspire to.
Right.
The irrational agent. all right. So, Lorenzo, did you want to ask your question? I saw you had your hand up.
It's okay. I mean, yeah, it was something about probabilities also. It's directed to Abai and maybe Bianca. She was talking about path integrals. So it seems that somehow in field theories, the probabilities somehow get lost or somehow change their meaning. I mean, we're used to the Born rule, as was pointed out just now. And the Born rule, I remind you, is the square modulus of the scalar product between the state of the system at some time, t, and the eigenstate of an observable at no time, I mean, in the Schrodinger picture, or vice versa in the Heisenberg picture. So first of all, there is time inside the Born rule. It's conditioned on time. It's a conditional probability. Probability of obtaining a certain result given that the time is t. So this already points out some trouble when you apply the Born rule to field theory. And indeed, people kind of forget about this when they calculate, for example, transition probabilities in which you have the overlap between two states and you forget about sometimes, not of course, Abai is not forgetting about it, but sometimes you forget about the evolution that you have to put a U inside there. So my question is about the fundamentals of probabilities in field theory. I mean, is it still the Born rule, like a scalar product between the eigenstate of an observable and the state of the system, or is it something else?
So I don't know if you refer to field theory or field theory with diffeomorphic symmetry, which are systems in which, in particular, you have this time evolution problem. And well, then essentially there's this basically distinction between physical Hilbert spaces and kinematical Hilbert spaces, and in fact, transition and transition amplitudes, and actually there is often indeed a bit of naive understanding of transition amplitudes, which, for instance, you know, you do compute with a path integral, but they do have a certain, I mean, there's actually a precise interpretation you can come up with. That is, if you have what we call a kinematical wave function that includes already a notion of time. It's actually kind of lots of, you can interpret that as lots of states superposed in time, lots of initial value problems at different times. And so you can actually decide to build states, for instance, which, you know, have a Gaussian distribution in time. So that way, if you make it to a delta function, you arrive at your sharp value at your typical, at your usual interpretation of transition amplitude, which is between states at sharp times. Of course, that doesn't might exist, so you do have to go back to a Gaussian interpretation. And secondly, there's kind of the notion of diffeomorphism invariant observables, and there's lots of work and also lots of talks at this conference about these kind of relational observables. And there the point is that the relational observables in itself comes with a time parameter. So it's kind of similar to a Heisenberg picture observable if you want. And so you can put it into a timeless state, or you can put, you know, you would put it into this inner product, physical inner product, or kinematical Hilbert group. Well, there's also kind of Arbeit's work on rigging maps. So that's a way to kind of work on both physical, on the physical Hilbert space and the kinematical Hilbert space. So this observable, so these relational observables indeed have information of a reference system, which gives you kind of a time coordinate and also parameter, which says, you know, I'm evaluating stuff at this time. And so that allows you also to talk about probabilities on this level. So there are subtleties, of course, if it comes to the path integral and interpretation, and you have configurations which, I don't know, you know, split off into baby universes, or they have some Euclidean things. So typically the idea is, as Klaus emphasized also, that the kind of a usual notion of time only emerges in the semi-classical regime, and there might be regions of the universe which do not have such a notion, like at the Big Bang or something.
Right. But as you just pointed out, you could have this relational time with these observables that you just pointed out. And so, for example, in quantum cosmology, we might use a scalar field as a clock. And we can say that there are observables like the density of the universe, of the anisotropies of the universe. And we can just ask the relational question, right? That when the scalar field takes this value, yes. So you can calculate those things explicitly.
Right.
And in that context, we also have a relation between between the path integrals and the so-called cosmological spin forms. And there's complete consistency. But again, I mean, you need this deparameterization, certain observables and so on. And just to conclude, and there is nonetheless a different, a larger question, that is to say, supposing I use two different fields as clocks, then I will get certain predictions. These predictions refer to two different notions of time. And is there actually a consistency between these descriptions? Now, to even formulate this question requires a lot of care, because the question should be well posed in both frameworks, so to say, both the parameterizations. But there are such questions that have been answered, have been looked at, and there are times in which one can analyze them and answer them. But that, I think, would be a more kind of a state-of-the-art limitation. But to begin with, I mean, one could just take a certain relational observable and talk about relational time by making one of the observables as being the clock. This is a bit like what Klaus was talking about.
No, I perfectly agree. And that's more or less what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. But the important thing to stress is that when you do that, you get not anymore a conditional probability condition on time, you get a joint probability distribution, right, in which time is also a dynamical value.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
So this is important. Okay, thanks. Hey, thank you.
Hey,